The Democracy Paradox podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute has a 40-year history of excellence in advancing research and education on global democracy and human development. Learn more about the Kellogg Institute, including its world-renowned visiting fellowships for scholars at various stages of their careers at kellogg.nd.edu.
Democracy is Eastern as well as Western. And what Japan and Taiwan and South Korea have done in the past few decades is remarkable, especially as these populist waves hit so much of the West, Europe, United States, Latin America. And I think that it's not at all hard to imagine, not very long from now, that Thailand looks a lot more democratic than now. Singapore looks a lot more democratic than now.
Welcome to the Democracy Paradox podcast. This is my daddy.
My name is Justin Kemp, and I am your host as we explore the democracy paradox. On May 14th, Thai voters participated in a consequential election. They sent a direct message that they wanted change and that they wanted democracy. About two-thirds of the electorate voted for political parties, pushing for civilian-led democratic government. Dan Slater has called this a revolutionary election in a recent post on the Journal of Democracy blog. You might remember Dan from an earlier episode when we were discussing democracies in hard places. He discussed Indonesian politics as well as his most recent book that was co-written with Joseph Wong, From Development to Democracy, The Transformations of Modern Asia. Dan Slater is the James Orrin Murfin Professor of Political Science, the Ronald and Eileen Weiser Professor of Emerging Democracies, and the director of the Weiser Center for Emerging Democracies at the University of Michigan. He's also among the most informed scholars about politics in Southeast Asia. Now, before we get started, I want to note that Dan and I recorded this episode a few days ago. At the time, Dan was worried that the Election Commission might invalidate some of the electoral results. However, yesterday, the Election Commission certified the results and endorsed the election of all 500 MPs. Still, there is a lot of uncertainty over who will become the prime minister. But this episode is not so much about the day-to-day politics in Thailand. Rather, its goals are to help explain the significance of the recent elections, help you to better understand the larger political dynamics in this country, and how recent events will affect the prospects for further democratization in Thailand. Now, if you like this conversation, please support the podcast as a monthly donor on Patreon or a paid subscriber on Apple Podcasts. You'll access some exclusive bonus episodes and early access to all new episodes. You can also help with a rating or a review on Spotify or Apple Podcasts. Like always, you can email comments or questions to jkempf@democracyparadox.com. But for now, here is my conversation with Dan Slater. Dan Slater, welcome to the Democracy Paradox.
Thanks for having me back.
So, Dan, loved your piece in the Journal of Democracy on their blog, Thailand's Revolutionary Election. It's interesting. There's been so many conversations about Turkey, so much focus on the Turkish election that I feel Thailand's been really overlooked. It was a very consequential election, in my opinion. And yet, I'm not sure that many people understand how important it really was. So why don't we just kind of start with the headline here? Why was the recent election in Thailand so inspiring?
Well, I think it was inspiring in the sense that it was really an occasion when youth voters, urban voters, kind of picked up on the momentum that they had gained from massive protests back in 2020. And really, you know, struck a huge blow against the military's grip on political power that it's basically had since 2006, at a minimum, when they had conducted their first coup against Thaksin Shinawatra, the former prime minister. And basically, since 2006, they've been giving, you know, dribs and drabs of civilian power through elections, but basically holding on to power for the military and its allies through an unappointed Senate and through a series of safeguards, which is basically, you know, relegated Thailand to being an electoral authoritarian regime since 2006. But from a deeper historical perspective, like even deeper than that, basically the military has been the supreme political force throughout Thai history. And, you know, 1932, the Thai military basically toppled the absolute monarchy. But rather than this becoming something that then led to popular sovereignty, it's really been military sovereignty in tandem with the monarchy. And so really the opposition in this parliamentary election won, you know, a substantial majority, two parties, the Move Forward Party and the Pheu Party. They won a substantial majority, and they both really are calling for the military's role in political life to be reduced, and in a more subtle way for the supreme position of the monarchy to be tempered as well. So we don't know where it's going to go next. The electoral results might not get respected. They might not be honored. But I wanted to take a moment to sort of say that the election itself was a very, very big deal, even if the fruits of it are sort of denied to the Thai people. And in some ways, it's important to recognize how much they've claimed, because then we should appreciate how much will be taken away if the electoral results aren't respected.
There's a lot to unpack there. And Thailand specifically, in my opinion, is one of the more complicated countries, because you've already put forward the fact that the military is heavily involved in its politics. There is a monarchy that is still heavily involved in its politics, and elections are fascinating as well. I mean, Thaksin Shinawatra, his parties have typically dominated Thai politics, Thai elections in the past. What I found really fascinating about this election was that Move Forward actually got more seats in this election. I mean, I think that's what really struck everybody, is this new political party, which isn't entirely new because it's kind of the reincarnation of a party that was made illegal. But how does it differ from Pheu Thai, that is kind of a reincarnation of itself, like of Thaksin's old political parties?
Well, so both of these parties, and you're right, in some ways the biggest story was that Pheu Thai didn't win. People expected Pheu Thai to actually prevail. And they did very well, but they came in second and Move Forward, really leaped forward and leaped past them. So now, rather than there being just one overwhelmingly powerful opposition party, Pheu Thai, there are now two. And now both of these parties, of course, are the kind of successors to previously banned political parties that were banned for a variety of reasons by Thai's courts. And Thai's courts are not independent. They're not democratic courts. And the courts have in the past done the bidding of these military regimes in banning popular politicians, unpopular to the military, popular to the Thai people, in banning them from politics. And so, yes, after the last election, the party called Future Forward was banned along with its leader. So Move Forward in some ways, you know, showed the popular backlash to that decision. So the fact that it had been banned in its previous incarnation ironically helped it, because it became a very, very clear galvanizing center for opposition. So the Pheu Thai, historically, the first time they won elections, you know, under Thaksin was in 2001. And basically, the story with Pheu Thai is it's essentially kind of a populist party, somewhat of a rural base. It really kind of stampeded to electoral victories by mobilizing the peasantry in the Northeast, who had not been really mobilized in politics before. Politics had been very, very focused on kind of the Bangkok political center. And so this is quite an earthquake. The fact that Move Forward, I mean, they won in Pheu Thai's strongholds. They won in all the big cities. They won nationwide. They won the youth vote. They've got a very youthful prime ministerial candidate. And Pheu Thai's candidate is also very young. And so there are now these two parties, which are at this point claiming and planning to work together to form a government, but they don't have enough seats to form a government because of the Senate. In a normal parliamentary system, they would have cleared the 50% easily. PETA, who is the leader of the Move Forward Party, he would be prime minister. Pheu Thai would be the secondary partner, all done and dusted, pretty straightforward and simple. The problem is you have a 250-member appointed Senate, which last time around voted unanimously for Prayut, the general, who is currently prime minister. And so they've got to get, I believe it's 66, the coalitional numbers keep shifting, but something like on the order of over 60 members of the Senate to vote for PETA as prime minister. And PETA is on the record as saying he wants to get rid of Thailand's lese majeste laws, which protect the king from insult. Now, Move Forward has said, we won't insist on that and join a coalition. We won't pursue that. But it's an uphill climb for a Move Forward-led government to recruit enough support from the Senate to actually get to the magic 50%, not just of the House, but of the House and the Senate combined. So 50% of 750, not just 500.
Yeah, let's come back to that. I mean, because I think that gets into some details and it gets into some questions. I mean, we still don't have a prime minister in Thailand after these elections. So it's still a little bit of an open question as to how the politics are really going to play out. But in terms of the history of Pattaya, which dates back, again, like we said before, to Thaksin, who was a prime minister dating back to the early 2000s, he's been labeled as populist, which among Democrats, small d Democrats, is kind of a bad word. How Democratic was Thaksin when he was in office, and has his movement changed over time after so many military coups?
So if we go back to the early 2000s, so Thai politics had always been very, very fragmented. And basically after the 1998 financial crisis, they changed the electoral rules and basically, you know, made it such that one party could win a lot more power. And that's what happened. And the party at that time was called Thai Rak Thai, or Thais Love Thais. And Thaksin was basically the richest man in the country. And so you can hear echoes of Berlusconi or echoes of Trump, if you wish, or what have you. But this idea of basically the most successful businessman in the country, you know, and he's a background in the police. So this is not a businessman who got there strictly through market forces by any stretch of the imagination. So he basically, through kind of force of money and personality, stampedes to this majority win. And so he was allowed to rule from 2001 to 2006. And, you know, it's interesting because this is really before kind of the populist turn we see around the world. So it's kind of a precocious case of populism, if you will, before you had this, you know, kind of wave of them in the 2010s. So it was, I mean, a decade before that. So ironically, it's around the same time as Erdogan is elected in Turkey. And so it was a, you know, basically an illiberal democracy, foreshadowing what happened with the Rodrigo Duterte government in the Philippines. There was a very vicious, extra-legal crackdown on suspected drug offenses. There was, I think, a substantial amount of corruption. And ultimately, what made Thaksin's rule kind of untenable was popular protest over his sale of these shares in his corporation to Singaporeans. And so basically, he was seen as a national sellout. And he had deeply suspect democratic credentials, I would say, was how people saw things in 2006. But then when people look at what has replaced it for the last 17 years, I think people tend to look back and say, well, Thaksin brought new groups into politics and he clearly had majority support, or he still has majority support. And so it's not really a case where there's a lot of debate on which sides were the democratic angels. I think it's pretty clear that Thai Rak Thai should have been allowed to stay in power. The coup was certainly not justified. And these Pattaya, you know, won elections since then. They too should have been given a chance to rule and try to do a little bit of a better job than they did before they were toppled in 2006.
Yeah, I'm not trying to justify the military coup by any stretch of the imagination.
Understood.
But what's interesting about Move Forward is that they come across as a much more liberal political party, if not a more democratic political party. And their alliance with Pattaya comes across to me as a little bit of an evolution of that movement as well after so many military coups, that it feels more democratic than maybe it did in the past under Thaksin. I mean, do you get that sense as well, or am I reading too much into that?
Well, I think it's hard to know until you have power. But I do think that Pattaya, and I mean, in the Thaksin family, if you will, because it's still largely a family-run enterprise, I think they've been very chastened by the experience. And I think that even before the coup, I mean, Thaksin was, you know, really trying to make, you know, very moderate noises about not challenging the monarchy and not challenging the military and what have you. And so I argue in the article that it wasn't really anything Thaksin was doing with power that led the military to get rid of him. It was much more just the fact that the military didn't want anyone to be rivaling their power. There's an analogy here in Myanmar, which is that the National League for Democracy, the NLD, the party of Aung San Suu Kyi, was just simply too popular for the military to stand it. They just couldn't take it. And so, like, no, we're supreme and we're going to stay supreme. And so I was thinking recently about all the arguments about, like, socialist parties and Islamic parties and how they moderate, you know, over time. I think there's something to that in all likelihood with Pattaya, in the sense that being denied power and spending decades of thinking of themselves as a worthy ruling party, I think probably means they're going to be willing to be probably more compromising than a party like Move Forward, which I think justifiably they're new, they're upstart, but they won big. And they should, by all rights, be allowed to form a government. my guess is Pattaya would be much more open to, although they claim they won't, but they will, in the end of the day, be more open to possibly working with more pro-military, pro-regime parties to build some kind of coalition if it turns out that move forward is disallowed, which I think is quite likely, from actually forming the government.
And I think it is important to note that Move Forward only has a 10-seat gain over Pattaya. I mean, it's 151 seats to 141 in a 500-seat parliament. We're not talking about just an enormous difference of seats. So even in a democratic system, it wouldn't be unheard of for Pattaya to actually form a government if Move Forward can't actually put a coalition together.
Yeah. Mathematically speaking, yes. I think politically speaking, it's a bit different in the sense that the kind of upsurge that this vote suggests and the fact that the two parties that both are so clearly trying to move the country away from military domination, from monarchical domination, the fact that those two parties won as much as they did means that an alliance between Pattaya and the old guard is a major, major step back from what the voters quite overwhelmingly demanded. And so not all number two parties are created equal. Not all coalitions between number two and number three parties are created equal, even though mathematically they're always possible. Here, I think it's also somewhat different from the Indonesian case. You know, Indonesia is a place where parties have been very, very, you know, ready, open, willing to share power with each other. And, you know, the divide between opposition and regime is much milder. So if it winds up that the party that doesn't, you know, win the most seats in parliament winds up getting the president, that's not any huge deal. That's not such a big problem. Here, it would really send a very powerful signal of the old guard just not being willing to see where all the energy and enthusiasm and youthful movement in Thai politics and in urban politics as well, where it's going and trying to put the brakes on it. So it would be more difficult, more controversial than simply saying, well, one and two are closed. Two can make coalitions a little more easily than one. So this is a nice kind of smooth compromise. It wouldn't be an act of compromise. It would be an act of oligarchic, autocratic, military assertion.
And in some sense, a betrayal.
Well, right. Well, this is the thing. So Pattaya, I think people were less convinced that they would avoid those kind of coalitions. I mean, Pattaya and the military and these military parties have a long history of dealing with each other by this point. It's been a couple decades of this dance in which elections are held and first Thairaktai, now Pattaya. Well, are we going to let them take power? What are we going to do? For a while, there's a prime minister from Pattaya, but then they run into trouble with the courts. So it's certainly not too difficult to imagine them coming to some kind of agreement, coming to some kind of modus vivendi with each other. But there's where Move Forward just throws an enormous spanner in the works and makes it very difficult for that to happen. And I think probably the military, the monarchy, a lot of these elites were pretty comfortable with the idea that they had engineered things in such a way that this election would yield maybe a Pattaya-led government, but one where Pattaya doesn't have all the power, where Pattaya has to share power with these more conservative parties, and that they could live with that. That's the way Thailand democratized in the 80s. That's the way they tried to democratize in the 90s after a brief military interlude. Basically, just don't be too radical. Make sure no party is too strong. And so in one sense, Move Forward is a huge complication because I think it messes up what was a kind of Pattaya-led, but kind of a wide coalition that was likely to take power. So in one sense, it's scarier for the military. But on the other hand, it's less scary in the sense that now there's not just one dominant opposition force. There are two. And what that means is, you know, to the extent that Pattaya was unacceptable because the Thaksin family was starting to look like a royal family of its own, that's no longer scary. And so to the extent that a more divided opposition is a less threatening one, the military and its allies could also say, we can live with this because it's not just one, it's two. And over time, divisions are likely to arise and they're not going to be displacing us as easily. So that's certainly a possibility.
Why did the Thai military think that more conservative parties would win in this election?
Oh, they didn't. Oh, they definitely didn't. And this is true in Myanmar too, by the way. So Thailand has a very long history of the military holding elections, of sponsoring political parties, kind of pro-military or at least comfortable with the military parties, and they never win. They never win. They weren't going to win this time. They haven't won in the 2000s. They never win. And this is why they've been engineering the political systems that they can basically not lose power, even though no pro-military party can win elections. So if you just hold free and fair elections, you know, for 20 years, it's been tie rock, tie, put tie, would just win outright. So again, now you put in the appointed Senate and you require the Senate to support any prime ministerial candidate. You throw sand in the gears, you make it very hard for, you know, an opposition party to just outright win power. You're willing to share power, but you're not willing to lose power. And that's even to the extent the military ever loses power. Even 2001 to 2006, the military didn't lose power. They didn't control the government. So it's all about engineering things so that when they lose elections, because they know they're going to lose elections, but they don't want to lose too much. And that's been the goal. And so in a way, the big question is, do they feel like they lost more or lost less by the fact that Move Forward has emerged and surpassed Potai? I think you could read it two different ways.
But I had the impression from your previous comments that you thought that the military believed that they would win more seats, that the government would be more fragmented than it really was. Not that Move Forward would fragment the politics with Potai, but that there'd be more conservative politicians that would win seats, that it wouldn't seem that they lost quite as big as they did.
That's right. It was a bigger landslide than expected. They knew they weren't going to win, but I think they expected Potai to win. Everybody expected Potai to win yet again. But the hope was, well, I hope it won't be too big of a landslide. And even if it's kind of a big landslide, they're still going to have to go through our Senate. It's not going to be so big that they don't need the, you know, the Senate to build a coalition. So as long as we can have Potai in a coalition government and not ruling on its own, like it did in the early 2000s, that's something that basically the military and the conservative power elite are more or less willing to at least experiment with and at least do on a trial basis. I wouldn't say they're comfortable with it, but it's something they're willing to countenance. Whether or not they're willing to countenance a party like Move Forward being in power, given its differences from Potai, is more radical on the monarchy. Whether they're willing to accept basically a coalition government that's totally the opposition, that basically all these regime comfortable parties are left out. Are they even comfortable with that? Well, only if they get a bunch of members of the Senate. And at this point, the Senate is just basically doing nothing while the election commission basically certifies the results, if for no other reason than because they think there's a very good chance that either Move Forward is going to be banned as a party, or more likely, I think, is that PETA individually as prime minister gets banned, in which case Move Forward would not be able to form the government. And so everybody's waiting to see if the courts kind of do their dirty work for them a little bit.
Well, let's do the math, assuming that Move Forward does not get banned. The prime minister is chosen by the 500-member lower house parliament, along with the 250-member Senate. So that would be 750 votes.
So you need 375.
375, which in theory, you could then get from the lower house of parliament exclusively. Why is it that they can't get those extra 85 some odd votes out of the lower house of parliament rather than using votes in the Senate?
Well, if you're one of these other parties in the lower house, if you're going to join a government, you're going to want cabinet seats. You're going to want a big share. And again, there are trade-offs here. So do you try to build a coalition with other political parties who are your competitors, or do you basically try to get the Senate, which is not elected, not political, not your rivals in that sense, just try to get, you know, a quarter of it or so to get on your side? So you're right. And they have to some degree, right? They have, I think, five or six other smaller political parties have joined this Move Forward led, Potai joined coalition as minnows along with the shark and the whale, if you will. And so, yeah, you're absolutely right. It could be at the end of the day, Move Forward isn't banned. As you say, PETA is not banned. They get something like 40 senators and maybe try to cobble it together with a few more political parties, you know, one or two more that are more conservative. And then the question is, would Move Forward be comfortable doing that? They've pledged not to do it. Even Potai has pledged not to do that. So I think they tied their own hands a little bit in that respect, but also that's what helped them get so much support. The voters wanted them to say, we're not going to just share power in a coalition with these guys. We want you to vote against this military government. And that's what they did.
So we're talking a lot about the military having enormous influence, and they do. I mean, the military is probably the dominant political force in Thailand at the moment, but Move Forward is very controversial because it takes a stance that's somewhat anti-monarchical. I mean, it's taking a stance against the monarchy that's nominally head of state, that nominally has some political power as well, and I think practically has some political power as well. Can you talk a little bit about how the monarchy in Thailand shapes politics as well?
So it's a little bit in flux at the moment because basically for the entire post-World War II period, Thailand had one king, and that king, King Bhumibol, was incredibly revered, incredibly beloved, had tremendous symbolic power. was basically politically untouchable, you know, kind of hovered above politics, it meddled in politics all the time, but hovered symbolically above politics. You know, but he died a few years ago, and his son, to put it mildly, does not have anything like the sheen on him that his father did. So part of, I think, what's been going on since 2014, when they did the second coup, I think part of what has been going on is that the military wanted to make sure they could get through the coronation of the new king in a way that it had control of, not have someone like Thaksin in charge for that, and just kind of secure the succession, secure the monarchy. Because the military, honestly, although it's very powerful, it's not very popular. I wouldn't say it's as bereft of popularity as the military in Myanmar, which is really bereft of popularity for very good reasons. But it's not like the Thai military fought for independence or has any heroic history. I mean, the Indonesian military is much more popular than the Thai military. So they need the monarchy. And that's what the former military leader, Surit, in the 1950s, he kind of realized. And so he sort of rebuilt the alliance between military and monarchy. And so ever since, that's been kind of this duumvirate in a way, the military and the monarchy. And so the question now is, how does that work with a not very popular king, with a king who's not a popular hero, who's not a king who, the second their image appears, people hop to their feet without any hesitation, because that's the way it worked with the former king. So what does that mean? Does that mean the military feels a bit weaker, feels like, okay, let's try to not step aside, but let's kind of share things when we're not losing too much? Do they feel like, no, we're really freaked out because we've lost our kind of symbolic cover, and so we can't live with a civilian dominated government at all? You know, there's a lot of ways this can cut, but basically the military can live with elections up to a point, as long as those elections produce results that don't give too much power to any party that is trying to take too much away from the military or the monarchy.
Why does the military continue to feel the need to tie itself to the monarchy? I mean, if there was a competent civilian leader, why wouldn't the military want to just hitch itself to that new leader and allow the monarchy to kind of wither away or just become less important over time?
Yeah, I mean, you make a good point. And I think that with the passing of the late king, I think that becomes more possible. So from 1932 to 1957, basically, that was the story, what you just described. So 1932, the military topples the absolute monarchy, and you basically get kind of an uneasy alliance between this military leader, Pibun, and a civilian leader named Preeti. And so Pibun and Preeti were more of a, you know, popular appeal, more leftist civilian, very popular politician, and a military guy. And basically, that alliance came apart, you know, in large measure because of World War II and because of the rise of fascism. And basically, Pibun and the military went with the fascists, and Preeti and what was called the Free Thai Movement went with the Allies. And so then after the war, it's a very kind of sordid history in which the young king, who's the older brother of the late king, was apparently murdered. It was apparently poisoned and murdered as a way of discrediting Preeti, who was his regent. So it's a real kind of Game of Thrones sort of situation here, right? But you're right. There was a time when the military did kind of rule without the monarchy as its ballast. And there was a time when military and civilian kind of sort of ruled together without the monarchy as ballast. So it's not unthinkable. And one could imagine, I think, some kind of alliance of military and perhaps Pattai. But again, there, I mean, the voters have really spoken. And that's not what the voters are down for. And so it seems to me probably the smarter play is to say, okay, you guys go ahead and form your civilian government. And this is more like what they did in Myanmar, right? You go ahead and form your civilian government. You won the elections, you go and take those positions. You get the prime minister, you know, you have the legislature, good on you. But you're not touching these reserves that we have. And if they did that, then the voters can feel, and I think Myanmar's voters felt pretty great about being able to give these landslide victories to the NLD in 2015 and 2020. I mean, they didn't capture the whole state. The military had lots of power, but there was a real civilian government. And so it seems to make more sense to me to have the military say, you go ahead and do that, you know, rather than, it's just not clear that an alliance that crosses that boundary between the old guard and this new youthful opposition, that that's going to hold water.
So you mentioned earlier in the podcast, and you actually mentioned this in your piece too, that Thaksin's group, the group that is now Pattai, didn't really have policies that differed substantially from the military. In the piece you wrote, Thaksin and Thai Rak Thai were not banished from the Thai political scene because of what they intended to do with their power. They were banished because they had already gained too much power. And I remember pieces in The Economist that talked about schemes in terms of giving farmers subsidies and stuff like that, that Thaksin had put in place that the military just kept in place. Like they tweaked them. They didn't abolish them or anything. I mean, there's a lot of different stuff that the military wasn't really upset or didn't really substantially change policies per se. How much of a shock will a move forward government be in terms of policies if they have substantial political power in Thailand?
Well, that's a very good question. You know, this is sort of thinking, you know, even further down the tree. You know, I would say, I mean, Thailand, like the rest of Southeast Asia, I mean, there's no really strong political left in the way that we would think about the political left in the United States or, you know, in Western Europe, like a real pro-redistribution, serious leftist government and parties that make those kind of demands. It's just not how things are kind of built in Asia. And I think it's partly the history of the developmental state and the way that the capitalist-led development strategies have got people accustomed to high rates of economic growth and not expect a lot of redistribution. I mean, these were all countries that during the Cold War were, you know, very much on the side of the political right, not the political left. And so, I mean, Indonesia, they just killed everyone who was suspected as a communist. They didn't do that in a place like Thailand, but in Thailand, the communist movement was very weak to begin with. And so I don't think there's anything in terms of, you know, certainly economically or the kinds of policies that we usually would array on a left-right scale that would be frightening to the elite that move forward would be proposing. I don't think that's where the story is. I think it's really more about just, as I was saying, just kind of the mere fact of power. If you're the supreme political power in a country, it's hard to see somebody else taking your spot, no matter what you're going to do. And I think that's the Myanmar story, you know, has been the Thailand story. And so things like getting rid of the lese majesty laws would be a very big deal. But I mean, even Move Forward itself acknowledges they know there's no way that's happening with any coalition we would have to put together. And so, no, I don't think that as people are currently scheming and calculating and saying, well, can we live with a Move Forward government or not? I don't think a lot of the conversation is, well, they're going to do this kind of redistribution or the kind of, you know, tax the rich sort of stuff that a lot of political scientists think, well, that's why democracy collapses, because the rich support a coup because they don't want the poor or the left to expropriate them. I don't think that's usually the way it works, and it's not the way it would be working in Thailand right now either.
Yeah, I didn't get the impression that Move Forward was a leftist kind of social democratic party per se, so much as closer to a Western style leftist party that is focused on identity issues and civil liberties. And I'm curious how far along that spectrum they actually move, because clearly they are opposed to the monarchy as an institution, and they're a very urban party and a very youthful party. How far along that spectrum in terms of protecting civil liberties, individual rights, and different forms of even sexual identity and other issues like that that we see in the West that would be very foreign to people in a place like Thailand?
Yeah, no, you're right. And I think on issues like marijuana, issues like LGBT rights, certainly just questions of kind of individual rights in general, you're certainly right that these are things that you know, that Move Forward has pushed on and has gotten them a lot of youthful support. And Thailand's a pretty open society. It's certainly conservative in certain ways, but it's also a very tolerant and open and vibrant, you know, sort of place, you know, and where I think religion and politics is a pretty light touch. You know, I mean, the Thai South is a different story where you've had a history of suppression of the Muslim minority and insurgency and the like. So that's a different story. But in central Thailand and in most of Thailand, yeah, I mean, identity conflict is not that intense. And there is sort of this opening for some pretty big steps forward in a rights kind of way. And so those are things that, you know, you can imagine, again, conservatives not feeling comfortable with. I mean, identity can really play a role, and it did certainly with the original toppling of Thai Rak Thai, insofar as it was seen by a lot of Bangkok elites and a lot of central Thais that this was a party of absolute hicks, you know, that had gone out to the northeast of all places. And it got only support from these vote selling, vote buying, corrupt, sub-civilized Northeasterners who are just like, they shouldn't be running the country. And it's actually a bit like what we saw in Brazil, to be honest, with the PT. Like a lot of the hatred toward the PT in Brazil, it's not just about like what the policies are. It's the sense that like a lesser quality human being is seizing power. I mean, really, really deep inequality and very, very deep sense, you know, a combination of class and regional identity and linguistic identity, because in the Northeast, they don't speak the same dialect of Thai. And so I think what you have is something where people need to feel like they're being led by people like themselves. And that's been part of the problem with Thai Rock Thai and Pho Thai all along. I think right now you certainly can't make that argument about Move Forward. You know, they've got national support and urban support and youthful support. Their leader's an accomplished businessman. The one they banned before was another accomplished businessman. I mean, these are not hard lefties. And I think the identity issues are the kinds of things that, again, in any kind of coalition would be kind of tamped down. So you could imagine, I mean, if they decide to move against Move Forward, whether through asserting a conservative coalition or even through a coup, I'm sure that kind of thing will be part of the pretext, part of the excuse. But I don't think it's really where the action is. I think it's really a question of, can we live with a Move Forward Pho Thai coalition? Are they going to move against military interests? Are they going to move against the monarchy's centrality in political life? Basically, how nice will they play? Will they think that they're the new kings of the country because they run the parliament and have the prime minister, or are they going to know their place? And if we think they're going to know their place, then maybe we can live with it, at least for a trial run as an experiment. But if not, then they could go all the way to just a full-on coup, because ironically, this seems like good news, but could be bad news. So the good news, in a way, although the Senate appoints the prime minister, the Senate doesn't vote in votes of no confidence. So although it takes a majority of 750 to appoint, it only takes a majority of 500 to topple. So what that means is, if the Senate basically says, let's do what we did last time, let's just all vote for a military guy like Prayut and work with the pro-government parties and just say, yeah, the election was nice, but no, we're not going to accept it. The parliament, the lower house, could just basically vote with no confidence right away. So they basically can't appoint their own prime minister at this point, the way the rules are written. And my worry is it could get even worse, which is, if they can't appoint a conservative prime minister, and if they really feel like they can't live with a Pho Thai Move Forward coalition, then we could be back in coup land, more like a Burma scenario where you say, yeah, election, that was nice, but we can't live with these results. And the country is ours after all. And it's up to us whether to accept an election result. Because at the end of the day, Thailand does not have popular sovereignty. They've never had popular sovereignty. The military and the monarchy have sovereignty. So they decide. The people do not decide. The military and the monarchy decide whether to let the people decide or not. And so that's what the past month and the next month are all about, is navigating that space.
Let's draw this parallel with Burma for just a moment here, because Thailand has had quite a few military coups. And most of the time when you have a military coup, it's seen as undemocratic, but somewhat stabilizing in terms that the state is exercising its authority. It usually doesn't result in political anarchy. But that's exactly what we got over in Myanmar, in Burma, not too long ago. Does Myanmar provide the Thai military any lessons after this election?
Well, man, I hope so. I think the lesson here, quite clearly, and this is something that, you know, Joe Wong and I are talking about in our book, From Development to Democracy, you know, that basically what these military regimes in developmental Asia have done, so Indonesia, Thailand, and Myanmar, is they set up these very kind of convoluted, you know, engineering processes, these inside jobs of handing power to civilians, some share of power, but basically through what, you know, we call these cohabitation arrangements. And so, you know, essentially the military keeps its power and the civilians get its share. And basically in Indonesia, that experiment worked really, really well for the military. They were able to get rid of their guaranteed seats and everything very fast, because elections were totally going to people they could live with perfectly fine. They got to get rid of the headaches of ruling, and they're perfectly comfortable with these civilian politicians. Like, it was totally fine. Myanmar as well. I mean, there, the problem was just the level of vitriol and of distrust between the military and the NLD was such that if the NLD was going to be the civilian government, the military was going to have a very hard time holding its fire, because it hates Aung San Suu Kyi so much. It hates the NLD so much. And I mean, it frankly hates most of Burmese society so much. So the military just was, you know, kind of just say, well, no, we're going to just take over again. It would not be anything like that extreme in Thailand, in the sense that there's not this divide between military and society that's quite so extreme as it is in Myanmar today. But certainly the lesson of holding elections, having very, very clear results that your people got stomped and people who want you to have a lessened role won overwhelmingly, to just ignore that result entirely is a real recipe for disaster. And they saw a big protest in 2020. I think that they're going to see that would pale by what would happen next. Now, that being said, I think that in a weird way, I almost feel like the opposition in Thailand right now, they've gotten so accustomed to this politics of, we vote for people and then they get banned by the courts, that it's almost been normalized. And so when people talk about this prospect that PETA is going to get banned because of these totally bogus, I mean, these charges are ridiculous. It's penny ante kind of stuff. Like, there's no way that you should be banning this guy from politics for this stuff. And that was true of his predecessor too. But people are like, well, yeah, okay, well then if he gets banned, then what do we do next? And there's a way in which people get acclimated to this kind of repression and see it as just expected. And they're not as outraged as you might think. So it's also possible, you know, if Move Forward basically gets kneecapped here by the courts, people can be very angry. But I think for a lot of people in Thailand, they'll be like, okay, so what's plan B? We don't get plan A, what's plan B? And that, I think, shows the success from the Thai military's perspective and the Thai monarchy's perspective. It shows the success of their engineering efforts. Like, they have moderated the Thai voter. The Thai voter doesn't expect to just like vote for a party and then get all the power. Like, they know perfectly well that's not happening. So Thai society, the Thai voter has been tamed essentially, as was Myanmar's, by decades of military rule and these gradual partial openings to democratic elections. So the system works. It worked in Myanmar too. They just should have stuck with it. And in Thailand, I think you look to say like, well, yeah, it wasn't as good as you would have hoped, but basically the system is working. You're able to have a real true election and you're not going to really lose that much power. So stick with your own plan. Like, your plan worked. And so hopefully they won't make the mistake in Myanmar, which is blowing up their own plan and saying, well, let's just go back to civil war with everybody. One can only hope there's some real caution in how much Myanmar has fallen apart. Even if Thailand wouldn't fall apart in quite the same way, it's not a pretty picture. And, you know, again, the reason that Thai military guys have as much money as they do is because the Thai economy is as strong as it is. So they don't want to see things go to like civil war status. They have a lot more to lose than the generals in Myanmar did.
I agree that it's very possible that the Thai voter has become normalized to the idea that parties get banned, that their votes get discounted through military action. But at the same time, when Future Forward was banned, nobody thought of them as much of a political force as Move Forward does today. There's clearly been a shift in terms of how the Thai people think about politics, what they're looking for out of political parties. There's been some kind of change that this election has demonstrated. I mean, do you feel like there's been a democratizing impulse in terms of the Thai people themselves, if not in terms of their government?
Absolutely. That's kind of the point that I try to make by saying this was a revolutionary election. We think elections are supposed to be alternatives to revolution. This is how you don't get revolution, is people can vote instead. But when they don't have sovereignty, that's the only way they can assert revolutionary pressure is through the vote and say, no, the military is not supreme. The monarchy is not supreme. We're supreme. I mean, that's the essence of democracy. You know, before you need free and fair elections, you just need for the people to be sovereign in the first place. And that's what's never happened in Thailand. And they're saying no, they're saying no more. They're saying that we insist on being the sovereign power in this country. That to me is what this election means. And that's just enormously important. And to not just exercise your popular sovereignty, but to demand your popular sovereignty is a revolutionary act. And if it gets snuffed out, it will be a counter-revolutionary act. And I think people should appreciate that. It's not just, well, there's a bunch of rich people running for office and, you know, some faction's going to win, some faction's going to lose. That really the stakes are as big as whether or not Thailand is going to develop popular sovereignty like its neighbors have, or whether it's going to remain stuck in this very strange position of a quite thriving, well-off modern country with a vibrant civil society and a very strong capitalist economy, but where the monarchy and the military still won't give up the top of the mountain.
So your recent book made the case that countries democratize through strength as well as through weakness. Thailand has really good economy for a developing country still. Why is it that Thailand isn't in a better position to democratize through strength? Why does it seem that Thailand's more likely to democratize out of weakness?
Well, it's a close call. I mean, both can happen. And certainly a point of our book is that you're a lot better off democratizing through strength than through weakness. So you should try to do that. And I think they've set things up so that they can largely do that. The big issue in Thailand has always been what I said earlier. They could never generate a political party vehicle for their interests. People have just never voted for these military vehicles. They do in some numbers, but never a majority. They can't win elections. And so it's always the case that there's a level of discomfort with, you know, the fact that we hold elections, we know we're going to share a lot of power, that basically the civilian side of the state is going to go to people who are not really our people. And they know that. In Indonesia, that's not a problem. The party leaders and the military leaders are all just thick as thieves. They get along great. There's no problem there. And so this is why that kind of victory confidence and stability confidence has been lower in Thailand, despite the fact that Thailand is, you know, even a better off place than Indonesia has certainly been so historically, and certainly has much less of a radical history of like social mobilization. So yeah, I mean, on the merits, there should be a lot of stability confidence and they should be very comfortable with this, but perceptions are where it's at and power is where it's at. And at the end of the day, if they think they can get away with it, then they might very well just say, take a mulligan, do it, or we'll have different elections, we'll do something, just throw sand in the gears, clutter it up, you know, not just let this very clear revolutionary election happen because they don't want a revolution. And they could see it as a revolution and say, we have to do this over in some way, or we have to reverse this in some way. This is too much for us to accept. We can't live with this. And so I don't think it's perfectly entirely rational. I think the rational thing to do is do what Thailand did in the late 70s, early 80s, which is to say, we are going to move to an electoral system and there are plenty of politicians who we know will basically not undermine the foundations for Thai growth and the fact that we're a Buddhist kingdom and all of this, and we can live with this full speed ahead. And that was the 80s. And, you know, with a hiccup in 91, 92, that was basically true for 25 years from the early 80s till 2006. And basically, I think the system worked, but at a level that I think any kind of rational political figure would say it worked, not necessarily a military figure. And this is one reason why military people shouldn't be in politics, because they just don't think about politics in a sensible way.
So Dan, recently I went back and I was reading some back issues of Journal of Democracy, and there's this one issue that touches on China and East Asian democracy. It's really fascinating because at the time, 10 years ago, I think it's 2012 or so, a lot of different writers like Larry Diamond, Francis Fukuyama, many others were looking at East Asia, including Southeast Asia, as an area to have the next big wave of democratization, the next area to really see democracy flourish. In fact, Larry Diamond in his piece, which was called The Coming Wave, wrote, within a generation or so, I think it is reasonable to expect that most of East Asia will be democratic. Now, obviously, a lot happens over 10 years. I don't want to force any predictions and try to ask ourselves whether or not that's going to completely come true. But I do see in Thailand that the people seem to be clamoring for democracy in a way that's much stronger than many other places in the world. I do see places like Taiwan and Japan that have avoided populist politicians. I do see some real opportunities for democracy within East Asia. And I wanted to get your sense whether or not you see some real opportunities for hope, even if it's a little bit more distant than we'd like, if you're starting to see that same sense that maybe there's going to be a good wave of democratization that could go through East Asia in the future.
No, I agree 100%. And I think that democracy is Eastern as well as Western. And what Japan and Taiwan and South Korea have done in the past few decades is remarkable, especially as these populist waves hit so much of the West, Europe, United States, Latin America. And I think that it's not at all hard to imagine, not very long from now, that Thailand looks a lot more democratic than now. Singapore looks a lot more democratic than now. Certainly Hong Kong, if it was left to its own devices, would look a lot more democratic than it does if China hadn't basically strangled the movement there. I think Vietnam is also in a position where, you know, as it gets closer to the United States and feels more threatened by China, that Vietnam also could move in a liberalizing direction. I think that Malaysia has certainly moved that way. Indonesian democracy, I think, has got its problems and it's not fail-proof. But again, I think that there's plenty of democratic potential. And I do think what we saw in Malaysia, and I think in Thailand also, it makes modernization theory look pretty good. That basically Malaysia and Thailand are places where economic development built such a strong urban middle class of people who just can't stand corruption, who just don't want to be bossed around, who don't want to be bullied, who want a little more freedom in their lives. I mean, Hong Kong, even more so, right? I mean, Hong Kong, Thailand, Malaysia, these are places, you know, and then we see it in Singapore, you know, this rise of the middle class through economic development, I think still creates real pressures for political change. And the difficulty of authoritarian regimes staying ahead of that and giving the people what they want without giving them democracy gets to be a more and more expensive and difficult proposition. And that's true in China too. The CCP is not just standing pat, preserving the status quo. They're constantly scrambling to find ways to maintain popular support given the rate at which society is changing. So all over East Asia, there's enormous democratic potential. And it's all there in the societies. And you have these very strong states too. And these strong states, when they don't want to allow it, they don't allow it. And so it's really, and this is the point we made in the book, hopefully they can think a little differently about when is the right time to reform and what's the right way to think about democracy. And that democracy very, 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 very rarely means that the old guard loses everything. And it never means that in developmental Asia. And it wouldn't mean that for China or Vietnam or for Singapore or for Thailand.
Well, Dan, thanks so much for joining me today. I want to plug the article one more time. It's called Thailand's Revolutionary Election. It's on journaldemocracy.org. Thank you so much for joining me. Thank you so much for writing it.
Always fun to talk to you, Justin.
If you are listening to the show, please leave a review. It really does help shows like mine stand out. Also, please share the show with colleagues and friends, because word of mouth goes a very long way. Facebook and Twitter are great, but really just talk about it. There's a full transcript at www.democracyparadox.com. Thank you for listening. The Democracy Paradox podcast is sponsored by the Kellogg Institute for International Studies, part of the Keough School of Global Affairs at the University of Notre Dame. The Kellogg Institute has a 40-year history of excellence in advancing research and education on global democracy and human development. Learn more about the Kellogg Institute, including its world-renowned visiting fellowships for scholars at various stages of their careers at kellogg.nd.edu.